This is podcast number 120 for the Well-Educated Mother's Heart. Hi, I'm Marlene Peterson, and today I'm talking about King Arthur and his Knights of the Round Table. This month has flown by, hasn't it? And there are so many more things and people I wanted to share with you. But we'll be back by next year and we'll pick some of them up. But I can't leave England without talking about King Arthur and the spirit of chivalry. While it's true that chivalry, as it was practiced in the Middle Ages, is dead, when we read these stories of King Arthur and his knights, we keep alive the spirit of chivalry in a new generation. A few days ago, I shared the experience of a Richard Wyke as he used fine literature as his primary teaching tool. He wrote, "A teacher in a high school informs me that the study, dramatization, and an attempt on the part of the children to live again its spirit transformed the life of the school, bringing in a reign of kindness and courtesy that had never before been known in her classes." I remember reading in one of the old books of a woman in England, a lady, who would bring poor youth out of the crowded, dirty London streets to her country estate for a sort of summer camp. She was appalled at their crude, coarse behavior and their profanity. Rather than tackling it directly, she immersed them in the stories of King Arthur and his knights, and the change in their behavior was remarkable. I've tried to provide you a variety of books to choose from so that you can find something that's appropriate for the ages of your children. For my daily sampler today, I'm going to read you the first chapter in a 1905 version written by Maud Radford for 5th and 6th graders so you can get a sense of it. This is probably the simplest of the King Arthur versions that I found, and I especially liked it because of the picture images she creates in telling the story. You'll see what I mean. But before I do that, let me share a few excerpts from the introduction of another book, Stories of King Arthur, to give you a little background on where the Arthurian legends came from, and also to give you a brief look at the beginnings of chivalry and what happened to it. The oath of the knight was really one of service to his God and to society, to protect the oppressed and to uphold the right. A knight took a solemn vow to speak the truth, to succor the helpless and oppressed, and never turn back from an enemy. We could use a little more of that in our world today, don't you think? Among the best-liked stories of 500 or 600 years ago were those which told of chivalrous deeds, of joust and tourney and knightly adventure. To be sure, these stories were not set forth in printed books, for there were no printed books as early as the times of the first three King Edwards, and few people could have read them if there had been any. But children and grown people alike were eager to hear these old-time tales read or recited by the minstrels, and the interest in them has continued in some measure through all the changing years and tastes. In these early romances of chivalry, Arthur and his Knights of the Round Table are by far the most popular heroes, and the finding of the Holy Grail is the highest achievement of knightly valor. The material for the Arthur stories came from many countries and from many different periods of history. Much of it is wholly fanciful, but the writers connected all the incidents directly or indirectly with the old Briton king of the 5th century, who was the model of knighthood, without fear and without reproach. Perhaps there was a real King Arthur, who led the Britons against the Saxon invaders of their land, who was killed by his traitor nephew, and who was buried at Glastonbury, the Valley of Avalon of the legends. Perhaps there was a slight historical nucleus around which all the romantic material was crystallizing through the centuries, but the Arthur of romance came largely from the imagination of the early writers. And yet, though our own ideal knight may never have trod the soil of Britain or Roman or Saxon England, his chivalrous character and the knightly deeds of his followers are real to us, if we read them rightly, for the poet's ideal was the truest truth. Though the sacred vessel, the Holy Grail, of the Christ's Last Supper with his disciples has not been borne upon the earth in material form, to be seen only by those of stainless life and character, it is eternally true that the pure in heart are blessed, for they shall see God. This is what the quest of the Holy Grail means. And there is still many a true Sir Galahad who can say as he did, "My strength is as the strength of 10, because my heart is pure," and who attains the highest glory of knighthood as before his clear vision, down dark tides the glory glides and star-like mingles with the stars. We call these beautiful stories of long ago stories of chivalry, for in the Middle Ages, chivalry influenced all that people did and said and thought. It began back in the times of Charlemagne, 100 years before King Alfred, and only very gradually it made its way through all the social order. Emperor Charlemagne was really a very great man, and because he was so, he left all Western Europe a far better place to live in than he found it. Into the social life of his time, he brought something like order and justice and peace, and so he greatly helped the Christian church to do its work of teaching the rough and warlike Franks and Saxons and Normans the gentle ways of thrift and helpfulness. Charlemagne's call to arms required that certain of his men should attend him on horseback, and this mounted service was really the beginning of what is known as chivalry. The lesser nobles of each feudal chief served their overlords on horseback, a cheval, that's French for horse, in times of war. They were called knights, which originally meant servants, German Knecht, and the system of knighthood, its rules, customs, and duties, was called chivalry, French chevalerie. When rightly exercised, chivalry was a great blessing to the people of its time. It offered high ideals of pure-minded, warm-hearted, courtly, courageous Christian manhood. It did much to arouse thought, to quicken sympathy, to purify morals, to make men truly brave and loyal. Of course, this ideal of character was not in the days of chivalry. Ideals are not often now very fully realized. The medieval, like the modern, abused his power of muscle, of sword, of rank. His liberty as a knight-errant sometimes descended into the license of a highwayman. His pride in the opportunity for helpfulness grew to the braggadocio of a bully. His freedom of personal choice became the insolence of lawlessness. His pretended purity and justice proved wanton selfishness. Because of these abuses that crept into the system, it is well for the world that gunpowder at last came to break through the knight's coat of mail, to teach the nobility respect for common men, roughly to end this age of so much superficial politeness and savage bravery, and to bring in a more democratic social order. The books of any age are for us a record of how the people of that age thought, how they lived, and what kind of men and women they tried to be. The old romances of chivalry give us a clear picture of the knights and ladies of the Middle Ages, and we shall lose the delight and the profit they may give us if we think only of the defects of chivalry and close our eyes to the really worthy motives of these far-off times, and so miss seeing what chivalry was able to do while it lasted to make men and women better and happier. After giving ideas to generation after generation of romance writers of many countries and in many languages, these same romantic stories were, in the 15th century, skillfully brought together into one connected prose narrative, one of the choicest of the older English classics, La Morte d'Arthur, by Sir Thomas Malory. Those were troublous times when Sir Thomas, perhaps after having himself fought and suffered in the Wars of the Roses then in progress, found some quiet spot in Warwickshire in which to put together in lasting form the fine old stories that already in his day were classics. Malory finished his book in 1470, and its permanence for all time was assured 15 years later, when Caxton set up the first printing press in England. The nobility of his age requested that he print the noble history of the Holy Grail and of the most renowned Christian king, Arthur. It was second in importance to them only to the Bible. In the centuries that followed, La Morte d'Arthur has been a constant source of poetic inspiration. Generation after generation of readers and of writers have drawn life from its chapters, And the new delight in Tennyson's Idylls of the King, almost of our own time, shows that the fountain has not yet been drained dry. Chivalry of just King Arthur's kind was given up long ago, but that for which it stood, human fellowship and noble purpose, is far older than the institution of knighthood or than even the traditions of the energetic, brave, true, helpful King Arthur himself. It links us with all the past and all the future. The knights of the 20th century do not set out in chain armor to right the wrongs of the oppressed by force of arms, but the best influences of chivalry have been preserved for the quickening of a broader and a nobler world than was ever in the dreams of knight-errant of old. Modern heroes of the genuine type owe more than they know to those of Arthur's court who swore to reverence the king as if he were their conscience, and their conscience as their king, to break the heathen out and uphold the Christ, to ride abroad redressing human wrongs, to speak no slander, no, nor listen to it, to honor his own word as if his God's, to lead sweet lives in purest chastity, to love one maiden only, cleave to her, and worship her by years of noble deeds until they won her. Antiquity produced heroes, but not gentlemen, someone has said. In the days of Charlemagne and Alfred began the training which continued in the days of Chaucer and Sir Thomas Malory, and many, many more, has given to this, our age, that highest type of manhood, the Christian gentleman. And now here's Chapter 1, How Arthur Became King. Once upon a time, 1,000 years before Columbus discovered America, and when Rome was still the greatest city in the world, there lived a brave and beautiful youth whose name was Arthur. His home was in England, near London, and he lived with the good knight Sir Hector, whom he always called Father. They dwelt in a great square castle of gray stone with a round tower at each corner. It was built about a courtyard and was surrounded by a moat, across which was a drawbridge that could be raised or lowered. When it was raised, the castle was practically a little island and very hard for enemies to attack. On one side of the moat was a large wood, and here Arthur spent a great deal of his time. He liked to lie under the trees and gaze up at the blue of the sky. All about him old oaks stood like giant guardians, watching sturdily over the soil where they had grown for centuries. Arthur could look between the trunks and see rabbits and squirrels whisking about. Sometimes a herd of brown deer with shy dark eyes would pass, holding their graceful heads high in the air. Sometimes a flock of pheasants with brilliant plumage rose from the bushes. Again there was no sound, except the tapping of a bright-crested woodpecker, and no motion but the fluttering of leaves and the trembling of violets half-buried in green moss. At times, when it was dim and silent in the wood, Arthur would hear bursts of merry laughter, the tinkling of bells and the jingling of spurs. Then he would know that knights and ladies were riding down the road which ran beside the trees. Soon the knights would appear on horses, brown, black, and white, with gaily ornamented saddles and bridles from which hung silver bells. Often the saddles were made of ivory or ebony, set with rubies or emeralds. The knights wore helmets laced with slender gold chains, and coats of mail made of tiny links of steel, so fine and light that altogether hardly weighed more than a coat of cloth. Usually the legs of the knights were sheathed in steel armor, and their spurs were steel or even gold. The ladies sat on horses with long trappings of silk, purple, white, or scarlet, with ornamented saddles and swinging bells. The robes of the ladies were very beautiful, being made of velvet or silk trimmed with ermine. Arthur liked to watch them flashing by, crimson and gold and blue and rose-colored. Better still, he liked to see the pretty, happy faces of the ladies and hear their voices. In those troublous times, however, the roads were so insecure that such companies did not often pass. Sometimes the knights and ladies came to visit Sir Hector. Then Arthur would hurry from the forest to the castle. Sir Hector would stand on the lowered drawbridge to greet his guests and would lead them with many expressions of pleasure into the courtyard. Then he would take a huge hammer hanging from a post and beat with it on a table which stood in a corner of the courtyard. Immediately from all parts of the castle, the squires and servants would come running to take the horses of the knights and ladies. Sir Hector's wife and daughters would then appear and with their own hands remove the armor of the knights. They would offer them gold and basins of water and towels for washing, and after that put velvet mantles upon their shoulders. Then the guests would be brought to the supper table. But Arthur did not spend all his time dreaming in the woods or gazing at knights and ladies. For many hours of the day he practiced feats of arms in the courtyard. It was the custom in England to train boys of noble birth to be knights. As soon as they were old enough, they were taught to ride. Later on, they lived much among the ladies and maidens, learning gentle manners. Under the care of the knights, they learned to hunt, to carry a lance properly, and to use the sword, and having gained this skill, they were made squires if they had shown themselves to be of good character. Then, day by day, the squires practiced at the quintain. This was an upright post, on the top of which turned a crosspiece, having on one end a broad board, and on the other a bag of sand. The object was to ride up at full gallop, strike the board with a long lance, and get away without being hit by the sandbag. Besides this, the squires had services to do for the knights, in order that they might learn to be useful in as many ways as possible, and to always be humble. For instance, they took care of the armor of the knights, carried letters and messages for them, accompanied them at joustings and tournaments, being ready with extra weapons or assistance, and in the castle they helped to serve the guests at table. After months of such service, they went through a beautiful ceremony and were made knights. In the country round about, Arthur, of all the squires, was the most famous for his skill in the use of the lance and the sword, for his keenness in the hunt, and for his courtesy to all people. Now at this time there was no ruler in England. The powerful Uther of Wales, who had governed England, was dead, and all the strong lords of the country were struggling to be king in his place. This gave rise to a great deal of quarreling and bloodshed. There was in the land a wise magician named Merlin. He was so old that his beard was as white as snow, but his eyes were as clear as a little child's. He was very sorry to see all the fighting that was going on, because he feared that it would do serious harm to the kingdom. In those days, the great and good men who ruled in the church had power almost equal to that of the monarch. The kings and the great lords listened to their advice and gave them much land and money for themselves and for the poor. So Merlin went to the Archbishop of Canterbury, the churchman who in all England was the most beloved, and said, "Sir, it is my advice that you send to all the great lords of the realm and bid them come to London by Christmas to choose a king." The archbishop did as Merlin advised, and at Christmas all the great lords came to London. The largest church in the city stood not far from the north bank of the Thames. A churchyard surrounded it, filled with yew trees, the trunks of which were knotted with age. The powerful lords rode up in their clanking armor to the gate, where they dismounted and, giving their horses into the care of their squires, reverently entered the church. There were so many of them that they quite filled the nave and side aisles of the building. The good archbishop, from where he stood in the chancel, looked down on them all. Just behind him was the altar covered with a cloth of crimson and gold, and surmounted by a golden crucifix and 10 burning candles. In front of him, kneeling under the gray arches which spanned the church, were the greatest men in the kingdom. He looked at their stern, bronzed faces, their heavy beards, their broad shoulders, and their glittering armor, and prayed God to make the best man in the land king. Then began the service. At the close of the first prayer, some of the knights looked out of the window, and there in the churchyard they saw a great square stone. In the middle of it was an anvil of steel a foot high, and fixed therein was a beautiful sword. On the sword was some writing set in gold, which said, "Whosoever pulls this sword out of the stone and anvil is the real king of all England." The knights who read this told the archbishop, but he said, I command you to keep within the church and still pray to God. No man is to touch the sword until all the prayers are said. After the service was over, the lords went into the churchyard. They each pulled at the sword, but none could stir it. The king is not here, said the archbishop, but God will make him known. Meantime, let 10 good knights keep watch over this sword. The knights were soon chosen, and then the archbishop said that on a fixed day, every man in the kingdom should try to pull the sword out of the anvil. He ordered that on New Year's Day, all the people should be brought together for a great tournament to be held on the south bank of the Thames near London Bridge. After a few days spent in jousting among the knights, each man should make the trial to find whether or not he was to be king. The brave youth Arthur did not know of the contest that was to be made for the sword. Sir Hector told him that he was to go to a tournament, but he did not tell him the reason for holding the tournament. So Arthur rode to London with Sir Hector, and Sir Kay, who was Sir Hector's oldest son, was with them. Sir Hector and Sir Kay went soberly in front. They were tall, stalwart men and rode black horses, their dark figures making shadows on the light snow that had fallen. Arthur, riding behind them, felt exhilarated by the crisp winter air which caused the blood to dance in his veins. Sometimes he stood up in his saddle and flicked with his sword the dead leaves on the oaks. Again he made his horse crush the thin crust of ice that had formed in tiny pools on the road. He was so happy in the thought of the tournament he was to see that he could have sung for joy. The road was not very wide, for few carts passed upon it, but it had been well worn by riders. Sometimes it wound through a bit of thick woods. Again it rose up over a gently rolling hill. From the hilltops the riders could see London far in the distance. It looked at first like a gray haze. Then as the three came nearer, the buildings, large and small, grew plain to the sight. The castles and huts, barns and sheds, smithies, shops and mills stood out in the keen sunlight. A high wall surrounded them, while on one side flowed the River Thames. After they had entered the city and had passed the churchyard and had almost reached London Bridge, Sir Kay discovered that he had left his sword at home. "Will you go back for it?" he asked Arthur. "That I will," said Arthur, glad of the chance to ride longer in the delightful air. But when he reached their dwelling, he could not get in. The drawbridge was raised, and he could not make the warden hear his calling. Then Arthur was disturbed and said to himself, "I will hasten to the churchyard we passed and take the beautiful sword which I saw in the stone. It does not seem to belong to anyone, and my brother Kay must have a weapon." So he rode on till he reached the churchyard, dismounted, and tied his horse to a sapling. The 10 knights who guarded the sword had gone away to see the combats and the tournament. Arthur ran up and pulled lightly but eagerly at the sword. It came at once from the anvil. He hurried to Sir Kay, who was waiting for him on London Bridge. Sir Kay knew that the weapon was the one that had been fixed fast in the stone, but he said nothing to Arthur, and the two soon overtook Sir Hector, who had ridden slowly to the field where the tournament was taking place. Sir Kay immediately told his father what had happened. The good knight at once spoke with great respect to Arthur. "Sir," he said, "you must be the king of this land." "What mean you, sir?" asked Arthur. Sir Hector told the wondering youth the reason why he was destined to be king. Then he said, "Can you put this sword back in its place and pull it out again?" "Easily," replied Arthur. The three returned to the great stone, and Arthur put back the sword. Sir Hector tried to take it out, but failed. "Now you try," he said to Sir Kay. But Sir Kay, in spite of great efforts, also failed. Then Arthur, at Sir Hector's bidding, tried, and at once pulled forth the sword. At that Sir Hector and Sir Kay knelt before Arthur. "Alas," said Arthur, raising them from the ground, "my own dear father and my brother, why do you kneel to me?" "Nay, my lord Arthur," said Sir Hector, "I am not your father. You are of higher blood than I am. Long ago, when you were a little baby, Merlin brought you to me to take care of, telling me that you were to be the king." Then whose son am I? Cried Arthur. There are two stories, the one that Merlin tells and the one that old Blaise, the master of Merlin, tells. Merlin brought you to me, saying that you were the son of King Uther and Igern, his wife. But because the king was dead and the lords powerful and jealous, he told me to guard you in secrecy, lest your life be taken. I did not know whether the story was true or false then, but you were a helpless child, and Merlin was a wise sage, and so I took you and brought you up as my own. Arthur was so astonished that he did not ask to hear the tale that Blaise told. He stood gazing at Sir Hector, who said, "And now, my gracious lord, will you be good to me and mine when you are king?" "I will indeed," replied Arthur, "for I am more beholden to you than to anyone else in the world, and also to my good lady and foster mother, your wife, who has reared me as if I were her own child. If it be God's will that I shall sometime become king, ask of me what you will." "Sir," said Sir Hector, "I ask that you make my son Sir Kay your foster brother, the steward of all your lands." "That shall be done," said Arthur, "and more, he shall have that office as long as I live." Then the three went to the Archbishop of Canterbury and related to him the story of Merlin and all that had occurred. At his request, they told no one else. At the command of the Archbishop on Twelfth Day, which is the 6th of January, all the great lords assembled in the churchyard. Each tried to draw forth the sword, and each failed. Then the untitled people came and tried. Everyone failed until at last Arthur stepped forward. He hardly more than touched the sword when it came away in his hand. At this, many of the great lords were angry. "He is but a boy," they said, "and not of high blood." They refused to believe the story of his birth told by Merlin and Sir Hector. And because of all the quarreling, it was decided to have another trial at Candlemas, which fell in the month of February. Again, Arthur was victorious. Then the great lords decreed that there should be another trial at Easter, and again Arthur succeeded. Next, they decided to have a final trial at the Feast of the Pentecost, which fell in May. Meanwhile, Merlin advised the archbishop to see that Arthur had a bodyguard. So the archbishop selected several knights whom the former king Uther had trusted. There were Sir Ulfius and Sir Brastias and Sir Bedivere, Sir Geraint and Sir Hector and Sir Kay were also chosen. These brave men formed a bodyguard for Arthur until the Feast of the Pentecost. At this time Arthur again drew out the sword from the anvil. Then the common people who had so far let the lords have their will cried out, "We will have Arthur for our king, and we will have no more delay, for we see that it is God's will that he shall be our ruler." Then all the people knelt down, high and low, rich and poor, and begged Arthur's pardon for the delay he had undergone. Arthur forgave them, and taking his sword, reverently placed it on the great altar beside which the archbishop stood. This was a sign that he meant to dedicate himself and his sword to God. Afterward the crowning was held, and all the brave men and fair ladies in the land were present. The lords wore beautiful robes of velvet and ermine, with gold and jewels on their breastplates. The ladies' robes were of purple and white and scarlet and blue and gold, and they wore many pearls and rubies and diamonds, so that all the place where they were assembled was glowing with light and color. But Arthur, who wore a plain white robe, did not think of the beauty and richness. He was very grave, knowing that he was about to take a solemn oath. He bowed his head while the archbishop set upon it the golden crown, which gleamed with jewels. Then he stood up before his people and vowed that he would be a good king and always do justice. All the people uncovered their heads and vowed to serve and obey him. And when he smiled kindly on them as he rode slowly through the throng, they threw up their caps and shouted joyfully, "Long live King Arthur! Long live the king!" King Arthur chose worthy men for his officers, making Sir Kay steward as he had promised. Sir Ulfius he made chamberlain, and Sir Brastias warden. Arthur gave offices also to Sir Hector and Sir Bedivere and Sir Geraint. After his crowning, the king set about righting all the wrongs that had been done since the death of King Uther. He gave back the lands and money that had been taken from widows and orphans and would permit no unkindness to any of his subjects. Thus, at the very beginning of his reign, his people began to call him Good King Arthur. Bye-bye. See you next time.